Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The title of what I want to say, of course, is deliberately provocative. I come, after all, from the same country as Monty Python, who used provocation in a very deliberate fashion, of which I'm sure you're all certainly aware. But I do think that there is a very, very serious consideration behind those words, and I suppose we first of all come across the notion of the cinema is dead, long live the cinema, from the old Ancien Régime French proposition of the king is dead, long live the king, which makes an implication that the institution continues, but the personalities, of course, very violently disappear and reappear again. I think that cinema so far, if you believe it was created in one wintry evening in Paris in 1895, if you believe it began then, though there are some people who would put a much, much earlier date, and that, of course, can be explained. If you believe it did then, or was created in 1895, that's given it 115 years. And 115 years for a aesthetic technology is not a bad innings. There is a theory about the notion of artistic development being responsive to the notion of three generations. I think we have to be a bit expansive about the notion of how long a generation is. But if, for example, you were to take fresco painting, you could say it was invented by the father of fresco painting, who we could say was Giotto. We could say that maybe the apogee or the son of the master would be somebody like Michelangelo, certainly the Sistine Chapel. And then we could say that the so-called third generation, and I put third generation in inverted commas here, would be somebody like the Carracci, who essentially threw the medium away. So there is a way that we have the first generation who eventually basically invents the language, which you could certainly say that was true of Giotto. And then there comes the generation which in some masterful way perfects the relationship between content and situation and media, and we could easily say Michelangelo. And then along come the Carracci, who are rather, I suppose, disturbed by the limitations of the medium and start fooling around with other materials. I suppose you could even say that even Leonardo da Vinci in painting The Last Supper was beginning to associate basically, after all, it is said in true terms that The Last Supper by da Vinci is not, strictly speaking, a fresco, but is a watercolor on dry plaster, but it did use some of the same associations and techniques. So even with da Vinci, who's introducing gum arabic and paraffin and other extraordinary new materials to try and what he would consider to make the Last Supper painting even better and more perfect and more magnificent than his forebears, we're already creeping in, I suppose, some notions of the demise of that particular aesthetic technology. Let's apply this technology, this notion of an aesthetic technology to cinema. In Europe, we would say that Eisenstein is the father, the creator, the manipulator of the essential vocabulary of cinema. And then we would choose somebody maybe like Fellini would bring the notion of the psychological narrative Christian ethic cinema to its apogee. And then quite quickly after that, you would have somebody like Godard, who would essentially rip up the blueprint and, in a curious way, decentralize to deconstruct cinema until really it's certainly its forefathers would almost not recognize what was going on. If you were American and you were interested in this theory, who would we choose? Griffiths? Griffiths by no means comparable to Eisenstein, but certainly the stupid man who introduce notions of narrative into cinema, which is the worst possible thing he could have done, could be said to be responsible for the origin, to be the father of American cinema. I would think probably, almost certainly, Orson Welles, who's not even American, would be responsible for the apogee, for the creme de la creme of the cinematic activity. And then you take your pick. Cassavetes has been said to have thrown away the cinema ethic, but you could choose Andy Warhol, completely different, but again, you could see why that choice could be made. So the notion then of the progenitor, the originator, the maker, in a sense, of the new aesthetic technology, then the consolidator, and then along comes the grandson who throws it all away. You could apply this technology to early portable oil painting, certainly in, early 16th century, maybe, in Northern Europe. You could apply it to various forms, if you like, of painting that happened in the late 18th century and beginning of the 19th century. So if you believe, then, there's a curve here, cinema already has gone through this system, in a sense, and we are now beyond and after Godard, and there's a way in which, as always with these circumstances, just as the impetus has somehow dried up or finished or come to the end of a progress, very happily some new technology appears on the horizon. That is not always a cause and event situation, of course, because the actual deconstruction of an aesthetic technology is relative to the beginning already of a birth of a new phenomenon. I think the last really true cinema was probably made by the Germans in the mid-1970s. So we're talking about people like Herzog, Fassbinder, maybe Schlöndorff, maybe Wenders, certainly Straub. And for me, these would be the last people who actually practiced some notion of what celluloid cinema was all about. And we're talking about, I know some people rather glibly say the end of cinema was the death of Fassbinder. I would put that just a little later than that, maybe about 78. Actually, my key, I suppose, date is the 31st of September 1983. Now, that supposedly is the date when the zapper, or the remote control, was introduced into the living rooms of the world. And there, though, that particular time, what could you do as you sat in your armchair? You could maybe organize the sound, maybe. You couldn't do much else, could you? You could change the channel. But think what's happened since 1983 now, and your ability, from a distance, in a sense, to be able to manipulate the television picture has grown exponentially. But the moment is significant because however simple that zapper control was, it did in a curious way take the control away from the filmmaker and gave it to you, the viewer. So it's the beginning, in a sense, of choice. A choice is very, very rare, if at all practiced in cinema before the 31st of September 1983. You film historians might know there were experiments in the late 50s in Czechoslovakia, of all places, of a cinema of choice, which was represented by buttons on the seats in front of you. The filmmaker made a film which had five endings, and you, the audience, could choose the absolute denouement. Total waste of time, of course. This notion of cinema being an individually perceived phenomenon, totally erroneous. No, cinema is not a social activity. It might be social when you go, or when you come away, or the tea party afterwards, but the essential activity, surely, when you watch a film, and maybe this is one of the reasons why you do it in the dark, is to be entirely on your own in an island of appreciation, enthusiasm, and fascination with what's going on the screen. And that's why it strikes me that DVD is a much better way to watch a movie than it does in a situation like this. You know the phrase, why on earth do audiences want to go in the dark and share their emotions with strangers? So the notion, then, of a cinema that's run its course, that has basically used up all the tropes and paradigms, that has created a whole series of genres of which we become excessively familiar with. I don't know how many of you, and of course we're not so very far away from Hollywood, actually go to the cinema anymore. Be bold. Put your hands up, those people who actually still go, buy a ticket, go into the dark, and sit for 2 hours and watch a movie. My God, there are rather a lot of you here. My adopted country is Holland, and it is said of the Dutch people that the average Dutch citizen only goes to the cinema once every 2 years. That doesn't mean to say, of course, that the screen is extinct, far from it, but the act of the cinema, with a capital C, is beginning very, very rapidly to disappear from our social habits and what we want to do in terms of notion of choice and educational imagery, whether it's fact or fiction. The Dutch, of course, often reserve one of their largest rooms to put in a very, very large television screen, but they watch cinema, if you can call it cinema anymore, under those sorts of domestic circumstances, with a cat on their lap and a glass of cocoa in their right hand. And they have choice. And when the film gets boring, they stop, go and watch something else, open the front door, feed the cat. When they don't want to be particularly interested in the romantic scenes or get bored to death with more special effects, you can fast forward. Now, these are very primitive ways in which to interact. But I do believe that this is a symptom of a much wider phenomenon. Every one of you in this audience, I am sure, owns a mobile phone, a laptop, and probably a camcorder. Is there anybody in the audience who doesn't own each of those objects? God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. Okay, I want to sort of embarrass you in front of your peers, but is there a reason why the gentleman over there refuses to be associated with God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost of the modern age? Yes. What about the other two objects? Do you participate in the camcorder? And you still operate on that strange combination of a television screen and a typewriter? You know, L'Autremont said, in his definition of surrealism, was the unexpected meeting of a sewing machine and an umbrella on an operating table. Don't you find the combination of a typewriter and a screen as surreal as that? Do you own a laptop? You do. Okay, God the Son is part of your universe. But I say that because, in a sense, because you have control of these three particular items and also the ways in which they can be made to interact, there is a way that choice is part of your vocabulary. And in a curious way, that, here's somebody who, though practices, I suppose, some notion of the purest cinema you can ever find, sincerely believes that YouTube was the greatest thing that could happen in the last 10 years, because in a curious way, the filmmaker is now in a much more direct association with his audience. We've done away with all those middlemen who exploit and often return very, very little into the relationship between the maker and the viewer. So in a sense, you're all now empowered. Some notion of democracy, some notion of control has been given to you. And surely this does really mark a changing point into those 115 years we've all sat passively in the dark, looking in one direction. And isn't that ridiculous, sitting in the dark? You are not nocturnal animals. What the f*** are you doing sitting in the dark? Second, look at you and the way this auditorium has been arranged. All the seats are looking in one direction. Goddard famously said, a cinema audience is only really applicable in its sentience for 180 degrees experience. If you're lucky, maybe a bit more, 210 degrees. So in a precarious way, an awful lot of the world is happening behind your back. You are all three-dimensional animals. You've elected to throw away huge amounts of your physiological vocabulary in order to position yourself in the dark in this situation. And you're looking. What are you looking at? You're looking at a rectangle, a parallelogram, a phenomenon with four rectangles. There's no such thing as a frame in nature. Why are you wasting your time concentrating on this very, very limited parallelogram? And if you watch a feature film, which is considered to be the apogee of filmmaking exercise, you all basically have to sit still for 2 hours. Think of it. Sitting still, looking in one direction, in the dark for 2 hours. It's not a very sensible human situation. But you don't have to worry about it, because this won't exist much longer. It'll all disappear, and you won't have to face these limitations and this sense of imprisonment. There is, I suppose, a general acknowledgement at large that in political and social terms, the notion of going to the cinema is a rapidly disappearing phenomenon. Would I be incredibly elitist to say that basic forms of cinema have been created, were created, as a very cheap form of entertainment for the proletariat? And therefore, those people who were wise enough to make that equation work made a certain sort of cinema that would appeal to that notion of cheap entertainment to the proletariat. In a curious way, down the road here, down the coast, there is a way that that particular notion still persists. Greater degrees of sophistication, you might say, but still the same basic predicament. But then a whole bunch of people, largely in Belgium and certainly in France around Paris, conceived of the idea that cinema should be an art form, that we should be able to make products which would stand up with those of Shakespeare, Beethoven, Cervantes, would be real powerful, exciting, mind-bending celebrations of life and civilization and our appreciation of both to make great artworks. Well, you know and I know, even though you might be a bunch of nostalgics for the cinema, and certainly on the left there's an awful lot of you, that that grand ambition has been very, very, very rarely ever achieved. So people like Bazin shouting his head off in 1923, their dreams, in a curious way, have not really been fully realized. Now, for all this, you can see that I have a certain amount of disenchantment about what cinema is, could be, should be, and ought to be. It's very, very, I suppose, arrogant of me to suggest that we have been wasting our time for 115 years. I don't suppose anybody can actually waste their time purposefully doing anything, or rather doing nothing, so we must have learned something. So if I'm very charitable, I will say we've had 115 years of prologue to cinema, and now, ladies and gentlemen, let's begin again and really create now something which is autonomous, self-respecting, stands on its own legs, cannot be deconstructed into anything else, and begin a whole new cycle of something which will make a movie like Casablanca, a movie like Star Wars, a movie even like Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin, look like a late 16th century Lantern's Light lecture. So when I say the cinema is dead, long live the cinema, I am accepting the fact that obviously we haven't been totally wasting our time for 115 years, but now we really ought to get serious and make something which is truly, truly a brand new species of phenomenon which cannot be deconstructed down into anything else and produce something which will really be amazing and empowering for our imaginations. If I had a lot more time, there is a way I would like to dig deeper and deeper and deeper into this phenomenon. Let me just give you a very brief scheme of why I believe, not just for political reasons, or should we say social reasons, or reasons of increase of the bourgeoisie and the declining of the proletariat and all those sorts of arguments, which are interesting, but that somehow cinema itself from within has created its own demise through a particular series of activities which seem to me to be deeply demoralizing. Now, mention them briefly. I've already sort of indicated them already. I would decry, I suppose, the notion of cinema from within because of four tyrannies. A tyranny of the frame. We've already mentioned it. The world, ladies and gentlemen, is not that shape, however hard you try to make it that shape. And in a curious way, it's very, very delimiting. You have a notion of a camera on your shoulders. Your eyes are never, never still, even in sleep. Your head is always moving. The prospect of a still image seen from a single glance, of course, is an incredible obstructing construction. And because it's man-made, it can be unman-made. So I think the cinema needs to get rid of the frame. Second, the close association, I'll mention Bazin again. Bazin in 23 said that the cinema was a combination of literature, the theatre and painting. Well, there's precious, precious little painting in cinema. There's an awful lot of theatre, and there's even more literature. So in a curious way, that definition in 23 still holds. So I think that cinema has to move away from the association of being a literary medium, a text-based medium, because every film you've ever seen started life as a text. I will challenge every single one of you in the audience to purposefully explain to me a film that did not begin with a notion of text. I used to say, you know, the early films were scribbled out in a few textual words on the back of a cigarette packet, but none of us smoke anymore, so that can't be true. But the whole notion, in a sense, whether your name is Godard or Almodovar or Lars von Trier, even now, every film you've ever seen starts life as text. We have a text-based cinema, we don't have an image-based cinema. So my second tyranny is the tyranny of the bookshop. I think we have to cut the umbilical cord between the notions of cinema and literature, most important. Third one, and these tyrannies get more and more difficult, is the tyranny of the actor. The cinema was not created to be a playground for Sharon Stone. It's not Sharon Stone's fault, it's the cinema's fault. I am convinced of the capability of an actor or actress could be this wide, and cinema only uses a few centimeters. The potentiality of an actor or an actress is infinitely superior to the uses to which we put them. Fourth tyranny, and perhaps the most difficult one of all, is we have to get rid of the camera. Let me give you two quotations. The two great, I suppose, greatest visualists of the 20th century would have been Eisenstein, who I'm sure you can put up there with Beethoven and Shakespeare, and Picasso. Picasso said, "I do not paint what I see, I paint what I think." And Eisenstein, great filmmaker, goes to Comes to. It's funny, when I talk about this, it has to be goes to in other countries. When I speak here, it has to be comes to California. And he meets Walt Disney. And he says that Walt Disney is the only true filmmaker ever. So this profound filmmaker, Eisenstein, says that Walt Disney is the most profound film director ever. Well, I'm pretty certain that Eisenstein wasn't referring to Disney or applauding him because of his anti-Semitism, because of his enormous business sense, or because of his sentimentality, but because he used him as a representative of a cinema that starts at ground zero. There is nothing there before. If you think about what Picasso said and compare it to what Eisenstein says, you can see a sense here. The camera is a very stupid instrument, however bright the camera operator. It only simply puts within itself what it sees through that dead eye of the camera lens. There is a way in which perhaps we should have started cinema at Richter scale ground zero, but we haven't. We've somehow pitched it at about Richter level six. It's too high up. We, in a sense, have got to claw back to that notion, and I must be careful about using this word, of recreation. If you say recreation very quickly, of course it becomes recreation. A dangerous. But there is a way, I think you can see, that in a curious way we have a cinema of mimesis, the representation of only solely what is put in front of a technical eye, has delimited, has controlled, has created the vocabulary of the cinema which we've had for 150 years. So these four phenomena, the tyranny of the frame, the tyranny of text, the tyranny of the actor, and the tyranny of the camera. I suspect it'll be a long, long time before we abrogate ourselves successfully around those phenomena. But if any of you, citizens of the 21st century, just think about those four phenomena, you can see how their potentiality has already begun to erode in all sorts of different ways. John Cage suggested, if you introduce more than 20% of novelty into any artwork, watch out, you lose 80% of your audience. He actually said, and added a rider, for 15 years. I think he was being very, very generous. If you take European Western painting, most people can cope with post-impressionism. Then comes cubism. Most people shudder, halt, hesitate at the barrier, and find it very, very difficult to leap the hurdle of Cubism to come into the glorious 20th century when painting really, really did come into its own. And that's not Mr. Cage's 15 years ago, that's Mr. Cage's 150 years ago. So I think that the sense of the notion of the shock of the new, the idea of approaching the unfamiliar, will of course be with us everywhere and is particularly persistent in a cinema, which I would argue is a very, very reactionary phenomenon. 1895, just think who's practicing in 1895. Van Gogh is painting in 1895. Now we have Warhol, we have Koons, we have all sorts of people who almost Van Gogh wouldn't recognize as painters. In 1895, Strauss is making music in Vienna. Now we are post-Stockhausen, we are post-Boulez, you name your favorites. Huge jumps in language appreciation and development of vocabulary. If we take literature, Thomas Hardy is working in 1895, and now we're post-Perec, we're post-Borges, we're post-Marquez again. Huge changes again in approach, in attitude, in notions of what these media are for and what they can do. What has cinema offered us? They say, don't they, that cinema is responsible for the notion of the glance, that the glance is the only thing that somehow, curiously, cinema has added to our vocabulary. But surely a slight examination of European painting in the last 600 years would have suggested that glance was certainly on the chopping block a long time before cinema came. So the actual inventions or the actual new approaches to notions of a vocabulary of meaning have been remarkably slight in the development of cinema. Now, you might think I'm being churlish because there's been 8,000 years at least of painting in the Western world and there's only been 115 years of cinema. But if you examine that equation, if you think about the amount of painting that existed available to most people before the Renaissance, it was comparatively slight. And it wasn't really until the middle of the 19th century that all of us were allowed to see the huge heritage of painting that's existed in the last 400 years. If you think about the number of films been made, just think about the number of films made in the so-called silent cinema period. Hundreds, millions and millions and millions of them. So the comparison in a curious way is not so churlish in terms of product. Maybe, of course, it's in terms of the development of aesthetic theory, understanding of cause and effect, and all those other multitudinous things that would be necessary to make a sophisticated art form. So those comparisons could be debated. So there is a curious way, then, that maybe despite its popularity, despite its history, again, for the reasons I've indicated, hope to have indicated to you, there is there not, a great sense of disappointment, a great sense of disenchantment about what the cinema has actually offered us in the last 115 years. What do we do about this? I can't continue to stand here being negative. Well, we have to do a lot of things about it, and you have to help as well. Think of John Cage. You have to be able to keep up with that 15-year divide. And I'm sure, with a great, huge sort of change, transmogrification, metamorphosis that we now believe, if only as distant observers, some of us, that cinema is really rapidly on the change. It's related, of course, to the fact that we have dumped celluloid, basically, and we are now into a television medium, which has all sorts of different characteristics. Nokia, telephone people, have just given me €2 million to make a film for this small screen. Now, I'm going to have to jettison an awful lot of my vocabulary to make this work, but the challenge is really very interesting and entertaining. Most people, I suppose, would utilize phenomenon like this in very short bursts, so I've got to find a different way to make a promulgation of a cinematic experience. I can't use particularly loud soundtracks because it's going to irritate the man at the tram stop standing next to you. It's going to have be careful about notions of contrast because you're going to have to watch these things in the bright noonday sun. The notion of wide shots is very largely going to disappear because wide shots on this small screen isn't going to mean very much. But it's interesting what has to be replaced. I'm supposed to be a communicator. I'm supposed to communicate ideas. I need to find the best possible way to do that. If I make a feature film, in association with maybe, of course, a different agenda, different time frame, I can get it to my friends in Beijing and Shanghai within 15 seconds. I make a phone call, here's your phone. Chances now, and I'm speaking, of course, very much as a European filmmaker, of me making a feature film of 2 hours length and getting it to my friends in Shanghai and Beijing within 2.5 years is really very unlikely. So I have to sacrifice and jettison parts of the association of the filmmaker making a big screen. But there again, you know, what filmmakers are left who would follow Kubrick's 2001? Isn't it extraordinary how cinema has somehow made itself unwatchable? Where can any of us go and see Kubrick's 2001 on a screen for which it was designed for anywhere in the world tomorrow afternoon? Impossible. Far easier for me to see an obscure painting, let's say The Blinding of St. Lucy by Caravaggio, which is in Palermo. I can go there on the next plane. And I know it's there, and I'm determined to see it. I know I'll find it. But isn't it strange that cinema, which is meant to be a mass medium, which is allowed to proliferate in the so-called thousands of prints, to be ubiquitous in a funny way, has made itself almost inaccessible, whereas Caravaggio, who probably never ever thought any of his paintings would last more than 100 years, is certifiably approachable and seeable. Of course, to mention Caravaggio is really rather important, because I was talking just now, was I not, about the Lumiere brothers inventing cinema in 1895, and I believe cinema was probably invented at the very, very end of the 16th century by four painters, Caravaggio, Rubens, Rembrandt, and Velázquez. They had everything at their fingertips, including movement and almost including sound. Mind you, there are some people who think that probably cinema was invented in 300 BC by the Chinese. And there are other people, if you know about the story of the Maid of Corinth, that would take it back to 1000 BC, Greece. So you can take your pick here. It all depends upon what your definition of cinema is, of course. So what do we do about these things? Well, certainly, as always, maybe you have to understand that there is a position here which needs questioning, and there is a position which means we need to tackle those particular problems according to our power of imagination at this particular point in 2010, and to build, since we are all postmodernists, and modernism is now a dirty word, we can never cut ourselves off from the past, how on earth could anybody ever think you could, but is to utilize then all these extraordinary new tools and technologies. Let me show you a range of possibilities. They are all experimental. They are all part answers to part questions. I would be extremely stupid to ever imagine that one had found a solution to them. But as always, it's a question of building a wall, and we have to do it brick by brick. Let me discuss with you one particular phenomenon which has always intrigued me. How is it that the screens on which we project our images have little or no representation or interactivity with actually what we project on them? Again, it's back to this phenomenon of the notion of the parallelogram, four right angles. In the 50s and 60s, cinema makers used to have a choice. You could play CinemaScope, VistaVision, etc. You could change the aspect ratio. But now, as you probably all know, there's basically one aspect ratio all around the world, and it's 16 by 9. This is, I suppose, a dominance created very largely by television, which demands standardization in everything. But once upon a time, rather like a painter could choose the aspect ratio of his painting, cinema directors could at least have a little leeway about recreating the ideal shape and aspect ratio for the content in which he was going to put it. But why, indeed, do we even play with a parallelogram? Italy has been extremely generous to me in the last 3 or 4 years for a whole series of propositions related not particularly to film finance, but related to museums and collections and art institutes who are very well aware of the responsibilities of education. There is a design museum just outside Milan who every 3 years, witness the name, put on an exhibition about contemporary design. About 3 years ago, they wanted to do the same thing, And their particular interest was to make an exhibition about Italian design between 1945 and now, or as it was then, 3 years ago. I suggested we should open up those doors a bit, and why not concentrate just on the last year since the Second World War, but to open up the field and take ourselves much, much further back, because again, the roots and the roots and the roots go on and on and on backwards into history. They agreed, and then I suggested we should make a form of architectonic cinema. We should get rid of these flat parallelograms and make of the screens themselves something that would try to contribute to the imagery on which you put it. So architectonic cinema. The means of distribution and the circumstances of architecture like this deny the possibility of us doing much about this screen. We could be like Abel Gance and invent three screens. If you were very lucky, five screens. And unlike Abel Gance, we now have extraordinary technology to synchronize our projectors, a thing he certainly never did. That's why nobody for 30 years followed on what his experiments. But even the notion of multiple screens, in a sense, don't completely eradicate or change the phenomenon. Italy. Italians in the audience? I know a lot of you are Italian origins, rather bombastic people, deeply endearing. We called our item Blow Your Own Trumpet. After all, they were boasting about 40, 50 years of Italian design. But what we wanted to do again was to acknowledge the Italianness of Italians, if I can be clumsy enough to put it that way, but also to make a demonstration of cause and effect of medium and content. Our first screen of many screens, and remember these are all three-dimensional, was a quarter slice of the world to give us an overview. And you can see how big the screen is by the size of the little red man. Our second screen, being Italian, was to make a screen in the shape of a triumphal arch. Rome is full of triumphal arches, which indicate a certain sort of subject which we're all familiar with. In order to make an embrace, should we say, of the globe as a very large space, and the horizon basically as being a determined, defining horizontal, we wanted to make a screen which represented, in a sense, the width of most of the notions of vision. And to compensate that, another screen which represented the height of the stratosphere. It always amazes me that the whole of civilization and life on Earth exists within about 6 kilometers, maybe a kilometer and a half underneath the surface of the earth or the sea, and then Mount Everest plus another half kilometer. So a very small space of time, of space, there is a huge amount of activity happening on the surface of the globe. And then because I had so much to say, I wanted a series of footnotes, so I added 3 more screens. So here I have a three-dimensional universe which has all sorts of metaphorical associations with our notions of space. All these screens are reversible. That's to say, you can see the image on the back as well as on the front. And there is one of the screens, and this, of course, is only a diagrammatic invention here. You can see the tall screen has a rather curious cut-off shape. That's because the screen itself was torqued, so it gave a certain three-dimensional notion of the actual space we were projecting on. So why don't we find a way, again, of all the particular characteristics of cinema to develop them and push them in new directions. This is what we did. It is an artistic, or should we say, a history of art culture, and is, of course, predominantly Italian. Thank you. Italy has been generous to me in the last 3 or 4 years. Some of you might know, recognize this name, Venaria Reale, is the name of a very palatial hunting lodge outside Turin, Torino, once upon a time owned by the rich aristocratic families of Savoy. They have just resurrected this huge, really massive palatial space. I think there were stables for over 300 horses. They actually built a village to accommodate all the grooms and the servants that needed to service this place. It's full of ballrooms and corridors and private apartments. It had been left to rack and ruin with the Italian army, who, of course, deeply abused the situation, but a huge amounts of European money were put into refurbish the whole affair. I think the ambition was to try and create an Italian Versailles, and we all know how big and huge and glamorous Versailles is. They were able, because basically the hard architecture was still there, although a lot of stucco work had fallen off and the plaster was much deteriorated, certainly to be able to pretty adequately recreate the shell. They had in collections a lot of furniture and a lot of paintings. But in a sense, this huge, thriving city, which in the midsummer months of the hunting season probably housed about 5,000 people, in a sense, however you played with it, and this is always, I suppose, a situation about the reconstruction of history, in a curious way, it could never, ever come alive. We suggested repopulating the palace, this huge palace. Obviously, there are examples, probably certainly in this country, certainly in Europe, where for small spaces of time, very expensively, you hire a whole bunch of actors and extras to dress up in costume and posit themselves in ideal places in a historical monument. I think it's a situation which deceives none of us, because even if you dress up like Catherine of Aragon and Henry VIII, you probably know that they are wearing Marks and Spencer's underwear underneath, so the entire notion of suspension of disbelief is very, very difficult. We, of course, could never be able to afford 5,000 people to dress up in costume and parade across these extraordinary architectural spaces, so we did it very largely with projection. We were fortunate in the fact that because there was a scarcity of wall decoration, there was an awful lot of white plaster walls everywhere, and we utilized those to project characters. I'm a great devotee of the 60s and 70s and early 80s Italian cinema, and have access maybe to certain of those actors and actresses who performed at that time. So we asked everybody from Sophia Loren to Gina Lina, Roger Brigida, to you name it, plus a whole series of very contemporary, I suppose, Berlusconi TV bosomy actresses to come and join us and dress in costume and pretend that they were dukes and duchesses and grooms and hunters and poachers and thieves, etc. So that when people entered this palatial situation, they were greeted with a cast. I suppose in the end we must have had 500 people performing for us. But certainly by way of introduction, we introduced a basic 50 characters who you would continually and repeatedly meet as you wandered through this vast expanse of basically architecture around about 1660. Here were some of our introductory characters.
Il mio nome è Bartolomeo Vernetti. Sono l'aiutante del primo pasticcere. Lavoro nell'ala settentrionale delle risorse. Mi occupo esclusivamente di marmo e di cristallo, rigorosissimo principe di Roma, che ha 5 anni.
Segretario. You get the idea. You keep meeting these same people with their characteristics. They fit into the hierarchy, the pyramid of privilege that existed in this castle, but they also had their own characteristics, which hopefully you would be engaged with as a form, certainly, of fascinating entertainment, but also as an educational vehicle, because by inference, through often recreation, they would be able to offer you information about the place you were now standing in, etc. The place itself, I suppose, like a lot of these grand palaces at that particular time, was really some form of marriage market. There were over 40 portraits of these ladies, which we impersonated.
Io veduta nei giardini, madonigella, mentre con eleganza cavalcavate in così
simpatico straniero. Non era un destriero, signore, ma uno stupido asinello con il reumatismo.
It was often possible to put one young lady on one wall talking across the room to a lady on the other wall, and of course we could multiply that until you maybe had six particular people in one particular space all conducting a conversation. One of those ladies, incidentally, was the mistress of Berlusconi for 6 weeks. This is how the actual notion of people and projections work together.
Un nobile uomo di lettere,
un gentiluomo di camera,
un intimo della duchessa,
sposato con una santa donna molto devota,
la quale si cosparge il corpo con acqua di rose proveniente da Parigi a 5 lire la boccetta per preservare il candore e la morbidezza della sua pelle,
e schiaffeggia senza pietà le orecchie delle sguattere quando tossiscono, starnutiscono o aggrottano le ciglia.
I told you this place was a hunting lodge used by the aristocracy in the summer months. And you could see by this diagram, we project on the ceiling, the left-hand wall, the right-hand wall, and indeed in front of the wall that faced you as you came into the room. And there are many, many permutations of where this was possible. Here is a whole series of anecdotes about the hunt, which were relayed continuously on loops in several rooms. We created in the kitchens and below stairs a multi-screen extravaganza to try to replicate all the activities happening in those places in 1680.
Me vado davvero. La lavanderia è inaccettabile qui. Tutta una spina. Ed è umida. Sì. Sa di muffa.
Il cattivo gusto insudicia le viscere.
E ci sono i pipistrelli. Sì, li ho visti. Li ho visti. Scendono dal camino nei miei capelli.
Se vi tagliate, benedicete il Signore. Egli vi mostrerà il vostro sangue e vi darà prova che siete vivi, anche se siete nelle cucine di un palazzo che alcuni descrivono come l'inferno in terra.
Ah, Orazio mi sentirà.
We are always used to the relationship of screen to auditorium, much like you have it now, where all the screens are vertical. But why should that be so? We put projectors at the ceiling and created, I think, the true sense of metaphor of an activity like this. All the people that slept in the royal bed.
Thank you.
So all the way to death and beyond, in terms of the activities of all the myriad people who lived in this space. Now, what you're seeing, of course, is all recognizably cinematic language, but it breaks away from notions of conventional narrative. It doesn't tell stories in the normal way. It reconstructs your relationship as visitors or as audience to a sense of space. And, of course, it could really be described as cinema outside of cinema. And there is, of course, as we all know, huge potentiality for this sort of activity. Let me show you something else, which, again, is still relative to the cinematic language you know, but is, again, performing perhaps in a different way. American composer David Lang, he and I collaborated on a project, indeed, we called Writing on Water, an Impossibility. We did this, first of all, in a Richard Rogers building in the City of London. And again, not so incredibly original as a concept, been done many, many times before. But what we added was, I suppose, relative to indeed the writing of Writing on Water, was a calligrapher. We did it with a London Sinfonia. It lasted, as you can see, only about half an hour. And the basic idea was to take a series of literary works which are world famous. Coleridge is The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Melville's Moby Dick, and Shakespeare's last play, The Tempest. We could say were all very watery, watery works of literature, and make a selection of suitable phrases, words, and ideas, and construct them to make a libretto for a series of singers. The best way, of course, to look at this performance is a live phenomenon. Sorry, I can't bring you the orchestra here. So what you're going to see is a representation. So the phenomenon, imagine that the second violinist is me, but I'm not playing a violin, but I am playing a very large television screen that can push and pull up to 2,000 loops onto as many differently shaped screens as I wish. But the third violinist is indeed not playing the violin either, but is a calligrapher. His name is Brodie Nieuwenswander, an extraordinary expert on calligraphy over the last 1,000 years in Western Europe. And he is interpreting the words taken from these three authors in association with what the music is doing.
Thank you.
another commission from Italy, this from the Florence Opera House. You might know this famous piece of music, very short. The situation in Warsaw, played with a narrator. This would also give me the opportunity to continue to play with the notion of live cinema, again, deeply associated with music. Here, again, I'm going to give you a representation which is filmically arranged so it can be seen on a single screen. But here are multiple screens in the service of a piece of music that probably you will recognize.
How I got underground to live in the sewers of Warsaw for so long a time. The day began as usual. Reveille! But it still was dark. Get out! Whether you slept or whether worries kept you awake the whole night, you had been separated from your children, from your wife, from your parents. You don't know what happened to them. How could you sleep? Trumpets again! Get out! The sergeant will be furious! They came out, some very slowly. The old ones and the sick ones, some with nervous agility. They fear the sergeant. They hurry as much as they can. In vain. Much noise, much too much commotion, and not fast enough. The Feldwebel shouts, Achtung, stillgestanden! Na, wird's mal, oder soll ich mich dem Gewehrkolben nachhelfen? Na gut, wenn ihr es durchaus haben wollt. The sergeant and his subordinates hit everyone, young or old, strong or sick, guilty or innocent. It was painful. The groaning
been hit very hard. So hard that I could not help falling down. We all on the ground who could not stand up were then beaten over the head. Have been unconscious. The next thing I heard was a soldier saying, "They are all dead." Whereupon the sergeant ordered to do away with us. There I lay aside, half conscious. It had become very still. And pain. Then I heard the sergeant shouting, "Abzel!" They started slowly and irregularly. One, two, three, four. "Abzel!" The sergeant shouted again, "Russia! Das meist von Fernand feiert! In einer Minute will ich wissen, wie viele zur Gaskammer abliefere. Abzählen!" They began again, first slowly. One, two, three, four, became faster and faster, so fast that it finally sounded like a stampede of wild horses. And all of a sudden, in the middle of it, they began singing the Shinoi!
Easy to point the finger at Nazi Germany, but ethnic cleansing and enormous amounts of violent racism is still part of a continual everyday situation on the globe. The idea then of all these various ways and means of trying to utilize a whole new technology of fragmentation, of multiple use, of repetition, of musical constructs. In a sense, these are all splashes in a big sea of possibilities, but it was very important for me to see if I could consolidate and bring these, all these sorts of ideas and many more that I do not have the time to show you into one magnum opus, one huge phenomenon, which would also essentially be a product for the information age. Is it not curious that 3 minutes of CNN and most of the television broadcasting stations of the world use CNN as an example, in the space of, let's say, 3 minutes, can show you split screens, diagrams, maps, contributions from all over the world, four lines of type, three of them moving, logos up in the left-hand corner, gives you a huge mass of information, but as you sit in your settee, you do not have apoplexy, you do not have heart failure. There is no equivalent, or hardly ever, and I challenge you to give me an example, of those sorts of excitements, of those sorts of eventing, of those sorts of phenomenon that persistently are used as the structure for the feature film, whether it's made here in this country or indeed anywhere around the world. There seems to be a gap between all the languages we are very, very familiar with and have no trouble. We find it very, very difficult to transform those languages into the not only the orthodox, but the unorthodox methods we associate with the feature film. What I wanted to try and do was to acknowledge that problem in a large work, which again is massively full of information, which again will not, I hope, give you apoplexy because there's so much to consider, that will give you multiple framing, that will give you hundreds of characters, it will give you many, many narratives, which will be a representation of the sort of spirit of life in the 21st century. The subject matter is the history of uranium. Uranium is found, certainly here in the West, in Colorado Desert in 1911. So we have a prologue to the film, which takes us from 1911 to the first big uranium nuclear fission event, which, of course, is in 1945 with Hiroshima. And the main bulk of this huge project would basically finish in 89 with the coming down of the Berlin Wall. Let's call this the first chapter of uranium. Now, I come of age, I'm 21 in 63, so I'm highly politicized. I do all the marching, the anti-bomb, the anti-Vietnam phenomenon. It's certainly the core center of my early political and social life. Today's young people would be worried about global warming, overpopulation, pollution of the globe. But it is very interesting. Fossil fuels, we are given, 12 more years to finish? And then we're going to very, very seriously be in deep trouble to keep our refrigerators going. And I'm quite convinced, sure that you have read all the information, that our rather tepid attempts to reproduce the notion of the energy of fossil fuels is not going to be sufficed with wind power or tide power or solar power. Either what we are playing with now is insufficient to meet demand, or all the new technologies are so much in their infancy, they're certainly going to be not around in 12 years' time. So it is inevitable that I sincerely believe, and I'm sure it's part of your political forum too, that nuclear power is going to come back. And it's going to come back with a vengeance because tried and proven, I think 70% of all energy produced in France, for example, is nuclear power. It represents, as Oppenheimer suggested, the very, very great savior or the very, very great disaster. And we don't have to elaborate. You know all the metaphors and you know all the realities. I wanted to examine this whole phenomenon then, starting in 1911, and in a sense still alive now. India and Pakistan are still shaking the nuclear fist at one another. But like all historical phenomena, like, for example, Tolstoy's War and Peace, which ostensibly is about Napoleonic War, though there are references indeed to battlefields and soldiery, most of the drama happens up front, with people asking and worrying always, as the whole breadth of historical time has always told us, those three questions. Who is sleeping with my wife? How do I pay the grocery bill? And does my child have whooping cough? Those three questions and all they represent, summation of all the lives which we basically live, which are domestic. All over the world, whatever a series of economic superiority, our educational value, is represented in those three questions. They are alive and well in Tolstoy's War and Peace. They're alive in all the Thomas Hardy novels. They are alive in all the historical novels you've ever read. So that would be my program. So we put together this huge story. I needed to have a very large canvas. We went all over the world to shoot our episodes. There are 92 of them. 92 is significant, of course, because 92 is the atomic number of uranium. The project was called the Tulsloopa Suitcases. Don't worry too much about Tulsloopa. He's an alter ego name for me. There is a way. Of course, I want my adventuring alter ego to have far more exciting experiences than I ever had. So, as this is a proposition of an alter ego, he or she can go to places where you cannot. So I take that license. But do remember the suitcases. There is a way, I suppose, the 20th century could be the most mobile century any of us have experienced. I can say this curiously, as I say it repeatedly in Europe, that the average American citizen does not work or live in the place where he or she was born. You are very, very peripatetic. You are very, very mobile. And we've seen throughout the 20th century huge movements of people, very largely involuntary, think of the Second World War. So the knowledge of a suitcase, the suitcase is very powerful. You know the phenomenon? In the middle of the night, you have to go, you have 5 minutes to pack a suitcase. What on earth are you going to put in that suitcase? You don't know where you're going, you don't know what your circumstances are going to be. I think the idea is not a clean pair of pajamas and a toothbrush and a new pair of shoes and as much money as you can lay your hand on, but it might very well be something related to your cultural baggage. It might be as seemingly ephemeral as your dinky toys, your Barbie dolls, your collection of pornography, your grandmother's love letters. What we wanted to do in 92 suitcases is to put absolutely everything in the world that anybody could put into a suitcase. Now, this is meant to be a project for the information age. I always felt that it would never be very satisfactory in the cinema, but my producer, on my behalf, can find cinematic money. So quite cynically, we used that as our main theme in order to generate huge amounts of material. But the project was intended really to be for 92 DVDs. At that particular time when we began in 2001, there were other forms like notions of the CD-ROM, for example, was still apparent. There is a huge amount of television interest, so we made three huge television programs. I ought to say to you, when we did finish the first 14 episodes of a 92-episode phenomenon, we had a seven-hour film. That's far longer than the longest Wagner opera you've ever sat through, and Wagner operas have intervals. I didn't want to offer anybody an interval. But also it's proliferated into a series of other things. We made an active internet phenomenon, which was having a hit. I think there were 60,000 hits a day for 3 years, and we also developed it into a VJ product, which again has traveled the world, and which we would very much like to bring to this city very, very shortly. I have to say the film was a total and absolute disaster in the cinema. I'll show you why.
I think you're just pooping and snooping.
Just pooping and snooping, Mr. Looper.
Mr. Looper.
Mr. Looper. With a pair of first class.
Quality class binoculars.
Made in Germany.
Made in Germany.
Good morning, Mr. Looper.
What's up, Mr. Looper?
Good morning, Mr. Looper.
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 Looper. Looper.
Mr. Looper.
Oh, right. Open your mouth.
I am the station dentist.
Open your mouth.
Not even a gas. Open your mouth.
I broke my leg.
You must run and climb
the barrier.
Imagine it's a garden wall.
There's treasure on the other side.
Are you ready?
Watch
for the dog.
1, 2, 3,
jump.
Has got his head on, keeps it for rain.
Can you truly, Mr. Looper?
Can you truly, Mr. Looper,
put a book that says
the book man
that says
can you truly, Mr. Looper, put a book that says man evolved from the apes in a little hot cheap suitcase along with the Holy Bible?
To see the Tulsa Looper story as fiction, it could be told as an episodic narrative of a man and his prison. The story starts in 1921 when Looper was 10, and perhaps it is still not finished. Looper was last seen and heard of, we believe, in 1989. If he were to be alive now, he would be 92.
And
isn't he
avaricious,
Borges, in two of his fictions, came up with two fascinating ideas. One fiction was about making a map the same scale as the world. That seems like an extraordinary science fiction idea, but now we have Google Earth, so in a curious way, we're already there. Another Borges fiction was the idea that a true history of the world has to be a history of every single one of its inhabitants, living or dead. Again, that sounds an absolute impossibility, but with genetic studies, with a certain amount of extraordinary ingenuity, we can reproduce everybody who's either living now or has been. So these fantastical Borgesian ideas already have come to pass in a deeply metaphorical way, but perhaps not so far away from a mad desire, in fact, to perfect those two notions. So in a way, the Tulsa Looper phenomenon for me was an attempt to make a map of the world, same scale as the world, and also to make a history of all of its inhabitants. But you can see the massive amounts of information, multiple screens, huge amounts of activity, makes the viewing of this, and ladies and gentlemen, for 7 hours, somewhat of a hard phenomenon to take. But I think you can see also, and you must, I suppose, excuse me to a certain extent about my cinema, the notion of this phenomenon being a cinema product, how it is absolutely ideally made for the interactive phenomenon we're all familiar with now. You can pause and stop. A lot of the frames have got text on them, which are only there for 1/24th of a second. So it's impossible for cinema audiences to be able to comprehend. But it is structured away. That's why we are making 92 VDs, where the whole phenomenon can, in common practice now, which we're all familiar with, be broken down and made very, very user-friendly. One of the things, of course, that we also made was an interactive video game. And let me give you just a very, very brief idea of how that worked, because that too was extremely complicated.
In the last century, an extraordinary man called Tulsa Looper archived his entire life in 92 suitcases. Although his life is still a mystery, we know that he was present at key historical events. Spending his life as a professional prisoner, he managed to collect a large amount of objects and store them in suitcases. In a way, the suitcases represent the world according to Tulsa Looper. By gathering and researching the suitcases, we hope to reconstruct Tulsa's life and through that discover the true nature of the 20th century.
Okay.
As you can imagine, the structure of the video game was to solve 92 puzzles, and when those puzzles had all been individually solved, was to find a way to make them all relate to one another. The game was online for 3 years, and as I said, about 60,000 people seem every day to have paid it some attention. And the winners of this game after 3 years were given the prize for the winner and his or her partner to travel to every single place on the globe that Tuss Looper had traveled in the film. And I was told that the winners, there were a couple of Belgians I seem to remember, spent 6 months on their travels. But the second prize was maybe even more surprising. Supposedly it was a night with Isabella Rossellini, but it was never claimed. As you can see, I have some 40 hours worth of material of all the sorts of stuff that we've been doing. My time has run out, but I am going to present another part of this oeuvre tomorrow of a different sort, which is related indeed to our experiments and association with painting and cinema. I thank you for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.